Welcome to the Metaphysical Martini Show, where wit and wisdom come together to bridge the gap between the spirit realm and the physical world. With Ani Avedisian, the Mad Shaman, a production of CosmicReality.com.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ani Avedisian. Welcome to Metaphysical Martini, three parts spirit, one part rational mind. Add two drops of optimism, give it all a good hard shake and pour, dress it with the olives of grace and empathy, sit back, sip slowly, and contemplate the wonder of cosmic co-creation. And a hearty hello to everyone out there, and a happy new year. Hello, hello, hello. Happy new year. Happy new year. Welcome to 2025, the year we stop struggling to survive, and instead we prosper and we thrive. Thanks for joining this crazy old lady for yet another round of cocktails on this week's Metaphysical Martini, the show that tries to sort out what's true, what's a woo, and what gets flushed down the loo in a world where we ask, why does the World Harm Organization, or the WHO, keep pushing these bioweapons, passing them off as medicine? Most have cottoned on to the game by now. So who is left for the WHO to misconstrue? Only those who are disenfranchised and easily surprised, and those who believe everything is exactly as advertised. Will we have an inauguration on January the 20th, or won't we? And if we do, and if we don't, will it have some sort of effect on the efficacy of Team Trump's plan to restore our nation? No, it won't. They're already at it. They're fixing deep corruption and runaway inflation. They're not even in power yet, but they're doing it. So why do the bad guys keep going after Team Unity? Surely they know by now they can't win. But there's this one little question that wriggles in our heads like a worm. When will the hammer of justice make the bad guys squirm? Oh, it can't be a day too soon. But, darlings, it will be soon, very soon. This journey that we're all on, some of us didn't know we were on it, but we're all on it. This journey had to be taken on the long and winding road. There were too many side quests to be taken care of before the great reveal was allowed to happen. And I honestly have to commend Team Trump, Team Unity, for having the grit to do this the right way, the slow way, the crossing the T's and dotting the I's and the incredibly laborious, tedious, gut-wrenching way around this that had to happen so that we are all on track for that historical moment of shift. We want a permanent shift in consciousness. We want it to be permanent, not a band-aid. We want a real boost in vibration because we want to live in a vibe that cannot hold this level of darkness, this level of deception. We want to live in a realm where people think for themselves and see themselves as manifestations of supreme cosmic intelligence, gods in bods, living as divine beings on an earthly plane. So all told, welcome to 2025. And welcome to the beginning of the new golden age. Welcome back, Martini Heads. It is lovely to be with you again. If you are new to the show, you brave souls, a warm welcome to you. Be advised, Martini Heads make no attempt to fit into anyone's box of ideas. We are free thinkers, we are patriots, and most of us are plinkers. Our ideology is libertarian, circa 1776. Note, I said ideology, not politics. The era of politics is over. Of course, we voted for Trump because we love America and we want to support America's sacred purpose to be a beacon for the rest of the world, a shining lighthouse of spirit-centered humanism. Are we religious people? No, we're not. We believe religion is a halfway house we should have walked away from years ago. And, you know, if you're a free thinker, whether you agree or not, if you're a free thinker, the reason for that should be obvious, because if you're a free thinker, you can think from another person's point of view without necessarily having to absorb and buy into it. So, does that mean we're atheists? You know, atheism is not a religion. It's not actually a thing. What does that even mean, atheism? Does it mean someone who does not believe the stories others wish them to believe? I think that's what it means. I have never met an atheist who wasn't in awe of creation. I guess they just think of it as too great, too marvelous to put into actual words. And I can relate to that. I don't define myself as an atheist because whatever supreme cosmic intelligence is, it is an energy and it is magnificent and it is alive and it is eternal and it is ever evolving. And you can describe it with beautiful romantic shaman language, or you can describe it with quantum physics and cosmology language. It's still awesome in the correct, you know, the correct use of that word, awesome. It puts you in awe. That's how martini heads feel for the most part. And, you know, some of us are part of some religion or another or whatever. And this is not a new movement. This is not a thing. We don't want you to be a martini head and that's what you identify as. No, you're a free thinker, a spirit-centered humanist, someone who wants to live as a sovereign soul with libertarian ideology, knowing that individual sovereignty is the most important point of reference for a physical incarnation. You know, martini heads know the cosmos is alive 24/7. We know, or we believe, I mean, what does anyone know, really? What do we know? We don't know anything. But we believe there is a source, not a tomato source, a source, a root from which all this energy emanates. And we study it, and we ponder what that means. We stay up at night and say, was there really a Big Bang? Perhaps there was more than one Big Bang. Maybe that banging is happening all the time. How could there only be one? Or was there only one? And then we read about string theory and we go, does that make sense? And does it have to be Big Bang or string theory? Or can we mix the both? And we ask ourselves questions like, when did physical worlds first appear? And what is the purpose of a physical incarnation? Is there an end game? Or is it just an eternal cycle? And if so, why? You know, we ask all the questions, but we also are not, I hope, arrogant enough to assume we will understand all the answers. Not at least until our realm vibes up, levels up, so that we can understand the information that, you know, higher forces are so desperately trying to shove inside our silly little heads. I'll tell you what we're not. We're not people who are going to go around preaching the end of religion. That will happen naturally as we all level up, as our understanding of our true magnificence is understood and accepted. You know, and at that point, following a particular path, following a particular religion, it really is rather silly because you feel like a grown adult having to put training wheels on your bicycle. So no one here is going to tell you to abandon Jesus or whoever is the prophet of your people. As long as it harms none, please do as you will, worship as you will. It is a free will universe. Worship a giant kangaroo if it pleases you and start the Church of the Hoppity Hop Hop. But don't be surprised if people dismiss you as an eccentric. By the way, just a minor point. Is it a minor point? I don't know, but it's a point because I'm asked this every single week and I don't you know, want to keep repeating the question, but Jesus, or Emmanuel, as we call him in my tribe, was a real person. What they wrote about him in the Bible is something else completely, but he was a real person. And the question I'm asked most is not whether he was real or not, is whether he was black or white. Okay, it doesn't really matter, but he was white. He was a white Jewish bloke who was very suntanned and had fair hair and fair eyes. He was white-skinned. It's not a big deal. You see, he had no notion of made-up concepts such as white privilege. He chose his bloodline for whatever it was that he had to do. And whatever skin color came with that bloodline was the skin color that came with that bloodline. He came for one reason, and one reason only: to wake us up, to point the way to a life in alignment with all that is, a life without religious bodies of sanctimonious pseudo-clerics dictating the will of God to a trembling, ignorant population. Don't know about you, darlings, I'm done with all that BS, and in time, so will everyone else be. So, let's get on with the show. I don't know what it's going to be like today. It's the first day of the year. I'm a little overexcited. I'm going to try and keep this all together. The main portion of our show is quack, nothing to do with ducks, questions, answers, and comments. So folks write in with questions and I make an honest effort to answer them. Beyond that, we have rotating segments, rather like the rotating beer selections at your local tap room. I'm never sure exactly how it will go, but the very last segment is always the cocktail of the day. And I have to say, that's my favorite part, because I do love a drinky poo. But because I am a reasonable facsimile of an adult, I confine myself to cocktails every other Wednesday on this podcast, because I don't want to destroy my liver or get a blood sugar disorder or lose my sanity. So on today's show, we will begin with quack, as we always do, then pay short but sweet visits to segments that have gone bye-bye. I think we'll do the cryptic mystic. That's always fun, you know, where we have our way with someone dead who liked to pray. Then we'll bring in Plato Chips, where we cast our vote on a philosopher of note. Then we're going to do a tiny pat of poetry, where I, Annie Mad Shaman Abedissian, torment my listeners with weird original poetry from the lost corridors of my vastly overrated mind. But fear not today, for I am going to be reading somebody else's poem. Ha ha! Lucky people you are. Then we'll play a quick visit to my weird and wacky tidbits from the anus of history. And we will end, as we always do, a little worse for wear, with the cocktail of the day, which I'm about to taste now. So hold on, darlings, don't go away. Sipping is happening. Okay, where's my little flute? Yeah, it's not an instrument flute, it's a champagne flute. It's a champagne cocktail. Hang on. That is the best champagne cocktail I have ever mixed in my life. That is absolutely textbook perfection. I am very proud of myself. Well done, Ani. And more about, how to make that towards the end of the show. It really is rather lovely. I think my male friends will find this one a little too girly for them, you know. But for me, who's all 100% curvaceous female, I'm going to have another sip because me just loves it. Hang on. Little tiny bubbles exciting my throat. Yum, 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 yum. All right then, keep it together, Ani. Let's start with quack. Yes. If you would like to share your thoughts with martini heads across the known universe, send your emails to me, Ani@aniabedissian.com, or via snail mail to Cosmic Ani, P.O. Box 714, Wilsonville, Oregon, 97070, USA. And please let me know if and how you wish to be identified, or I shall refer to you as Omit Personal Details. All right, my darlings, let's shake up the fishbowl of perpetual perplexity and see what pops out. A shaky, shaky, give it all a little shake. Mix them all up real good. Okay, what have we got? What have we got? What have we got today? Our first of the day. Our first of the day. And my first drink of the day too. Okay, our first of the day comes from a chap named Anton, who gives no location, but I'm sure he's somewhere. And Anton asks, when religion goes away, as you keep saying it inevitably will, do you think there will be religious minorities holding out in rural areas, fleeing from persecution? Will they be allowed to go into town to get supplies and avail themselves of basic services? Anton, darling, you make it sound as though religion will be cancelled by an act of parliament and enforced through brutal measures. I can't see that happening, can you? I mean, this is an ascension period, not a period of oppression. We've had that for 4 years. We're moving away from that into ascension. If folks want to follow whatever path they want, the path of icons and iconography, they will always be free to do so. No one's going to stop them. You take the old Soviet Union. You know, many religious peeps fled to remote areas of the old Soviet Union when communism reared its ugly head. And, you know, they did so because, well, they would have been exiled anyway, you know, for remaining faithful to their faith and to their way of life. But here in America, the America devoid of New World Order propaganda, there might come a time when such folks may be considered eccentric, but the whole point of a free-thinking society is to let anyone think whatever they want, even if their thoughts keep them in a tight space. No one is going to take it away. But like all the evil that is present in the world today, these things will collapse under the weight of, you know, under the weight of their own dysfunction. And I think it's better that way. I mean, isn't it? No planned demolition, no people sitting there smirking going, oh, you're so stupid, you believe in this, oh, you know, none of that anymore. Let it just fall, and we will deal with the debris as needed. Thank you, Anton, and a happy new year to you, and worship however you want, whoever you want. I'd rather you didn't worship Lucifer, but besides that, do your thing, man. The world will move, and if you want to move with it, you can. And if you don't want to, that's fine, love. This is America. You do what you bloody well want to do. Just don't hurt anyone. Okay. Oh, let's have a little sip of champagne for that. Oh, lovely. And this champagne's particularly good, by the way. Yummy. Okay. What else came in? Not so much as usual, actually. Sort of kind of slim pickings today, but let's have a little shuffle. Shuffle, shuffle. And this is from Lena in Hartlepool, UK. Oh my God, I have been to Hartlepool. It is up there on the North Sea, on the east coast of Britain, near a lovely town called Durham. Yeah, it's cold, very cold. And Lena asks, why haven't the ETs, who are supposed to be so benevolent, beamed down, set up education centers, and helped us to overthrow our corrupt leaders? Okay. Letters like this come in from time to time. Lena, darling, what would that look like? You know, do you think? I mean, what would that look like? 10-foot-tall Pleiadians beam down en masse and set up education centers. It sounds a little indoctrinating, doesn't it? Set up education centers of all things, and then took up arms against the establishment and, you know, their minions on our behalf. Doesn't it smack of, oh, you poor pathetic humans, you can't even manage to overthrow a corrupt government. How do you expect to be admitted into the Galactic Federation? By the way, it is a little known fact that all Palladians originally hail from Scotland. Anyway, moving on and back to the question, Lena of Hartlepool. You know, One hates to quote these well-worn platitudes, but we gain through the pain. We do. We cannot delegate our evolution any more than we can delegate our salvation. We have to jolly well buckle up, I think, and just get it done. And really, we do have ET help. They're not just floating around up there going, oh, look, that's interesting. What's happening on planet Earth today? Oh, this race is killing that race because their prophet said this and their prophet said that. And these people are killing each other because even though they have the same faith, they're disagreeing on the number of sacraments and they're killing each other over it. I mean, how boring must that be for them? Look, we do have ET help, but there is a prime directive, just as there is in Star Trek. And that is that no race can interfere in the evolution of the less advanced races without permission from the highest authority of that moment, whatever that happens to be. Honestly, I imagine they see us in the same way human parents see their toddlers scream and shout at one another for no discernible reason. You know, no need to get involved, darling. No need to intervene until it gets bloody. Lena, I think we need to be more vocal about corruption. And we need to step up. And we need to get involved in our local governments. And I think we should never give up. And we should never surrender until we have routed the corrupt. It's on us, really, to reach that critical mass in vibration, and then people can come in. You know, I also have to say, to all the ETs orbiting our little mama Earth, oh, I feel for you, you poor suffering bastards. You must be bored out of your giant alien heads. I promise you, some of us down here are pedaling as fast as we can, trying to make up for those who can't seem to find the pedals. And if we seem ungrateful, I assure you, nothing could be further from the truth. If not for you and your mission to protect Mama Earth, mankind would be lost to the cosmic archives. And to Commanders Hatton and Ashtar, who I have the pleasure of speaking with every so often, every 3 to 4 weeks, and to all the space cadets up there, big love to you all. One of the greatest joys of my life thus far has been hanging out with you. And I doubt this will happen, but I wish I could meet you in person, face to face, in physical body, and not just through astral channels. Well, maybe that day will come. Who knows? Earth will have to level up quite a bit for them to be able to land and survive here in their Palladian bodies. Or else we're going to have to level up so that we can be something, we can go to the spaceships, because some of those are huge, and there are little holding areas for people with lower vibrations. One way or the other, we've got to level up. That's all there is to it. What else came in today? Oh, thank you, Lena. Thank you. Happy New Year to you. What else came in today? Let's see. This segment is going to be shorter than usual, my darlings, so we can squeeze in the other mini segments, you see. So I think we'll take this one, maybe one more, and then move on. Shaking this up, and this is from Trish near what I think is Burlingame, Vermont. And Trish says, would you care to comment on Trump's picks? I assume you mean the people he picked for various positions. No, no, I have no meaningful input on that. Not my team, and I have no bloody idea really what's going on any more than anybody else does. It's his team. And I wish I was on it. And this whole process is part of something so much bigger, something the white hats have prepared for decades. I'm going to step back and trust the team on this one with just one little word to my fellow patriots. We are all doing very, very well with this ascension thing. We're all doing very well with overthrowing the great evil that has captured every aspect of every single person's life on this planet. No mean feat. But don't expect that every single pick of his is going to work as expected. Don't expect that everything's going to go completely smoothly. And, you know, all bets are off for everything. The only thing I can tell you in my heart of hearts, I'm absolutely sure, is that Team Unity have got this. And if they drop the ball on something, someone's going to be sitting on the bench and they're going to get up and they're going to substitute themselves and they're going to pick up that ball. So don't you worry about a thing. And the last quack for today, let's shuffle the fishbowl around a bit because there's two letters left in here and I'm going to pick one of them. And I'll pick this one. And this is from Tanqueray Tim. Oh, what a great name. And such a perfect name for a martini head. And Tanqueray Tim wants to know, in a cocktail, how did I know you were going to ask a question about cocktails? I mean, well, I did probably because your name is Tanqueray Tim. Titi says to me, Titi, Tanqueray Tim, in a cocktail, how many ingredients are too many? And is the dressing an ingredient? And also the bitters, are they an ingredient? Is that an ingredient? Right. Titi, I am open to experimentation and I am not a strict classicist. But since you asked, in my opinion, three ingredients is optimal. Three. And I don't count bitters or dressing as ingredients. If someone is new to mixology, I highly recommend starting off with the classics, the ones with fewer ingredients. For example, the martini, the old fashioned, the whiskey sour, and one of my favorites, the Manhattan. Mmm, a classic, perfect Manhattan made with good rye whiskey. Mmm, yummy, yummy. So I advise learning how to get the most flavor from your cocktail using as few ingredients as possible. You should learn how to take a spirit, such as whiskey, mix it with simple syrup and bitters, pour it into a low-ball glass with one chunk of ice, dress it with a Luxardo cherry or a candied orange twist. Ta-da! Whiskey, sugar, bitters, a bit of sweet-tasting edible dressing. You have a wonderful, simple cocktail. And if anybody has ever tried my old fashions, they talk about them for years. Easy and yummy. Now, Tanqueray Tim, that said, don't be a Puritan. No, because we don't like Puritans. On this show, we don't like Puritans. We don't like people who are sanctimonious and stuck up and just dress in black all day long with little pretty bonnets. Don't be a Puritan. There are many cocktails out there with more than three ingredients, and they're good. They're good. Experiment with them. Try them all. I mean, not on the same day, darling, you know, obviously, but try them all and you will soon find your favorite cocktail genre. I've experimented with, well, I'm 65 years old. I've been drinking since I was 30. Probably thousands of cocktails by now. And I still go back. If someone says, Arnie, what's your idea of a cocktail? Manhattan, martini, old fashioned, whiskey sour, something like that. Okay, thanks for that question. I'll have another sip of my champagne now. Ooh, lovely. Good luck, Tanqueray Tim. Wherever you're from, if I ever meet you, we'll make a martini together. And that's it for Quack today. Thanks to all the martini heads for writing in, because we wouldn't have much of a show without you, would we? Keep them coming, darlings. Bring me your weird, your wonderful, and your marginally disturbing stories, and let's share them with all the other weirdos in the world. Woohoo! All right, and now it's time to bring back some of those older segments that you say you missed, so I'm going to bring them back today for you. Today, we are going to do the cryptic and mystic, where we have our way with someone dead who liked to pray. Gosh, I love saying that. And today's Holy Roly is none other than St. Gregory of Narek. And yes, folks, he's an obscure one foremost. St. Gregory of Narek. He is widely revered as one of the greatest figures of medieval Armenian religious thought and literature. He was born in the city of Narek about 950 AD, common era. And Gregory came from a line of scholars and churchmen, so really he's just, you know, continuing the family business. He received his education under the guidance of his dad, Bishop Khosrov, who's quite famous in Armenian circles because he's the author of the earliest commentary on the Divine Liturgy. And he also received some instruction from the Vartabed, the abbot of Narek Monastery there, whose name was Ananiah. Gregory, you know, and his brothers entered monastic life at a very early age. And Gregory soon began to show how excellent his mind was. He began to excel in music, in astronomy, in geometry, in mathematics, in literature, and in theology. He made quite a name for himself as a bit of a brainiac, and that's good, because I've seen his statue. He was not a good-looking man. He could not go forward with that. Just as well, he had a good brain. So what do you do when you have a great brain, you want to get educated, and you have no looks? No one wants to marry you. You become a priest. In 950 AD, the circa around that time, you become a priest. So he became a priest at the age of 25. He dedicated himself to God, because that's what priests do, most of them. And he lived most of his life in the monastery at Narek, where he taught at the monastic school. We believe he began his writings with a commentary on the Song of Songs, which was commissioned by an Armenian prince. Despite the reservations that Gregory was too young for the task, the commentary became famous for its clarity of thought and language and its excellence of theological presentation. Well, who wouldn't want excellence of theological presentation? He also wrote a number of famous letters. He wrote odes, melodies, various discourses, and he wrote a type of Armenian religious devotional hymn called a sharagan, which I don't think it's actually part of the Divine Liturgy per se. I think they're special little songs for special occasions they bring out, but they're beautiful, dreamy, sort of Occidental verse, you know, mixing with the Oriental, the East and the West. Absolutely beautiful music. And many of Gregory's prayers are included in the Divine Liturgy, by the way, celebrated each Sunday in Armenian churches around the world. But his masterpiece, and I've got to be honest, I mean, the chap was a damn good writer. And his pieces to God, I mean, they're moving, even though they're a little bit too over-emotional for me. But his masterpiece is considered to be his Book of Lamentations. And I warn you, it is a Book of Lamentations. It's also known as the Book of Narek. It is comprised of 95 prayers, each of which is titled Conversation with God from the Depth of the Heart. The central theme, well, is everyone's central theme, really, man's perceived separation from God and his quest to reunite with him. You know, I think the Greeks have a word for it. I like apotheosis, you know, going back into your divinity. So St. Gregory described the work, you know, the book this way. He said, its letters are my body and its message is my soul. I mean, he and the book were one. He poured the deepest musings of his prayerful contemplations with the Lord in this book. He called the book an encyclopedia of prayer for all nations. It was his hope that it would serve as a guide to prayer for all people all over the world. And, you know, we've had the printing press for quite a while, but finally in 1673, with the advent of movable type, Narek's book was published in Marseille, 1673. And it's been translated since then into 30 different languages. Let me give you a couple of little verses from his prayers and in English so that you understand it. The soul's every movement is a reminder of God, the taking of a step, the extension of the right hand, the raising of the arm, with thanks for good work, with shame for bad, for familiar conversation and public address, in rational discourse, in works of success, in the fervor of virtue, day and night, we are guided by you, Lord, in the useful movements of our spirit, asleep or awake. Accept with sweetness, Almighty Lord, my bitter prayers. Look with pity upon my mournful face. Dispel all bestowing God my shameful sadness. Lift, merciful God, my unbearable burden, for you are glorified by all creation forever and ever. Amen. And we read those things and we go, how wonderful, how much he loves God and this and that, the other. And then we catch ourselves and we go, oh my God, quite literally, as a race, we humans have put ourselves through the ringer trying to reach God, get back to God, to know our true nature through God, and the immeasurable suffering we go through to get there, when there is where we already are. Why are we so slow to learn? Gregory of Narek, anyway, I just wanted to introduce you to him. His works are not that easy to find in print, especially in English, but they do exist if you poke around, and they can be a bit pricey, like $50 a book. But there is a Kindle version on Amazon, at least there was the last time I looked. And as always, ask your local library to procure a copy. Please use your local libraries. Thank you. That was Gregory of Narek in The Cryptic Mystic. And now, by popular request, our philosophy corner, Plato Chips, where we get to vote on a philosopher of note. And today, we see through the prism of existentialism as we take a quick peek at the life of Simone de Beauvoir. Simone de Beauvoir, born in Paris, 1908, remains one of the most influential thinkers of the 20th century. She's known for her expansive works on existentialism, ethics, and feminism. And she was an integral part of the existentialist movement alongside Jean-Paul Sartre. For those of you who are thinking, what is existentialism? I think the best way to describe it is, it's the belief that the philosophical belief that each of us are responsible for creating purpose and meaning in our lives. We ourselves are responsible for that. And we believe in free will, morality, and primarily facts. So that's existentialism in a nutshell for you. Beauvoir's magnum opus, I would say, was The Second Sex. The book she wrote, The Second Sex, it delves deep into the treatment and perception of women throughout history. It's in this groundbreaking work that she coined the famous phrase, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. That might confuse a few people these days that are already confused. But through this, de Beauvoir challenged traditional views of femininity and gender roles, highlighting the societal constructs that bind women. Additionally, her philosophical approach was a combination of existential thought with deep insights into human freedom, ethics, and gender dynamics. De Beauvoir's philosophy wasn't just theoretical. She lived her beliefs, consistently challenging societal norms, advocating for women's rights, setting the stage for many feminist philosophers that followed. If you want to get a taste of her books, there's two I'm going to recommend for you. Definitely The Second Sex, which she wrote in 1949. Probably the best known of de Beauvoir's books. It really was a landmark work of 20th century feminist philosophy, dealing with women's positions in society throughout history. In 1960, 11 years after its publication, de Beauvoir wrote that it had been an attempt to explain why a woman's situation still, even today, prevents her from explaining the world's basic problems. Among numerous contributions to human knowledge, it helped establish the distinction between sex and gender. Though it has come in for significant criticism over the past seven decades, it remains essential reading because we need to read everybody's point of view on everything so that we are confident that we have made the right choice ourselves. Do not be afraid. Don't go, oh my God, gender stuff. I don't want to read it. Everyone's mad. Read it. Read it and understand perhaps the roots of the dysfunction that we have today. Connect some dots. The other one of de Beauvoir's works that I'm very fond of, and I should get that out and read it again. For me, it was a very sweet little book. I don't know why, but it is Memoirs of a Dutiful Daughter. She wrote that in 1958. It's a sort of an intimate portrait of her growing up in a bourgeois French family. It's about her adolescent rebellion against the conventional expectations of her parents, her class, and you know how determined she was to establish herself in her own intellectual right. So the existential ambition she felt, it was honestly and truly, she was a young woman in the 1920s, and even though the dresses of the flapper era were delightful and the cocktails were even better, you know, having ambition as a woman and really insisting on doing things your way, it was actually far from the norm for a young woman in the 1920s. So good for you, Simone de Beauvoir. You know, she writes about friendships, her loves, how she learned about life, the forging of lifelong relationship with her fellow student, who is, of course, Jean-Paul Sartre. Yes, indeed. That was him. They hung out together and were quite happy together in their own little existential dream there. So Simone de Beauvoir, I really don't understand why people don't read her anymore. She's an essential part of understanding the evolution of women's roles. So read her, de Beauvoir. Pick up The Second Sex and pick up Memoirs of a Dutiful Daughter. She has a huge body of work. Read whatever the heck you want. Don't take my word for it. All right. Thank you. And that is the end of Plato Chips. Darlings, I have this little Telegram group of spirit-centered, you know, patriots. It's a closed group. If you want to join it, please do send me an email. And you have to have a little interview with me, unfortunately. It's not the end of the world, but we've been plagued with trolls and strange people. So it is a closed group. Why am I mentioning it? Because do I care whether you join it or not? I don't know. But my co-admin, a very talented woman and a political expert, ClaireCat367, wrote a fabulous poem. Absolutely fabulous. She wrote it the other day, and it is an archive of the times. And I think that this is probably something that future students will put in their history textbooks. I really think that this is something that's going to be the folklore of the day. And, you know, when you're looking at the folklore of the day, you go and you look at the poets. What did they write? You look at the novella writers, the short story writers, the journalists. Of course, everybody will know that the journalists were rubbish in this era. So they are going to go and they're going to look at the memes and they're going to look at social media and they're going to look at the poets. This is really just an excellent poem, and I couldn't be more proud that this woman is my friend. So this is from ClaireCat367, and it's her welcome to 2025. So here we go, everybody. Deep breath that I read it well, because usually I only read my own poetry. I don't mind if I F that up. And I read poetry by dead people, and they're not going to care, are they? So here we go. Welcome to 2025 by ClaireCat367. As this crazy year closes, can't help but reflect on the clown show and chaos and think, what the heck? Inflation, deflation, stagflation and debt, election fraud, scary fogs and taxation theft. We've had drone fear and bird flu and psyche ops galore, controlled opposition, cow farts and much more. It's amazing we made it to the end of this chapter, yet continue to meme them and mock them with laughter. Donald Trump is our president, the loony libs banished, the truth tellers thriving while mainstream news vanish. Woke BS is failing, DEI is old hat, the evil ones losing their minds over that. Exposure, disclosure, and truth are the aims of the brave freedom fighters who are winning this game. Accountability reigns, and MAGA patriots won't fail, dispensing true justice, sending traitors to jail. Now a golden age dawns, as has been foretold, and American spirit burns fierce, bright, and bold. Freedom beckons, and liberty calls us to hear the message of hope and to be of good cheer. As independence and sovereignty return to our hands, we are strong in our faith with love and light for our land. Making America first as this new era begins, ringing in the new year and knowing God wins. Huzzah! What a wonderful poem. Brilliant. And that's by my friend ClaireCat367. Who is also just really very much up on what's going on in the world. We are very happy to have her in our group, because if we didn't have her in our group, we wouldn't know what the heck was going on half the time. So there you go. That is the end of our little pat of poetry. And now, my darlings, I think we have enough time. I wanted to do a series of weird and wacky tidbits from the anus of history. And then I thought, okay, it's New Year's Day. Let me look at the history of New Year's Day and when it became a holiday, etc. And I started to go down this long rabbit hole, and I thought, oh God, you know, I love my podcast, but I'm not going to spend hours and hours and hours going down this rabbit hole. And then I was going through my email, and I get a newsletter from an organization called American Minute, and I really love all their little tidbits. And guess what they wrote about today? Yes, January the 1st. So I think that that's, I'm just going to go with what they have written. So, you know, liberally edited, as I always do. But this is all about January the 1st from the American Minute. So I was wondering, how did January the 1st become New Year's Day on our calendar? And it does sound like a very simple question, but you have to sort of go around a bit to find the answer. And American Minute suggests that we take a look at the origins of our calendar. Prior to the invention of clocks, watches, and digital devices, ancient people used calendars based on the moon, whose lunar cycles incrementally shifted through the seasons every 19 years, serving as an enormous generational clock. And of course, countries had their own calendars, usually connected to agricultural growing seasons. You know, Sumerians, Egyptians, Assyrians, Elamites, who are the ancient Persians, the Zoroaster folk, the Greeks, the Hebrews, and anybody else who was around at that time and grew food. Now, those calendars had different numbers of days in a week and different numbers of weeks in a month, often with an extra catch-all month in the winter of varying lengths. Are you with me? Just stay with me. The ancient Babylonian calendar began with the first new moon after the spring equinox. The Egyptian calendar was tied to the annual flooding of the Nile River. The word calends is the Latin name of the first day of each month in the Roman calendar. As the Roman Empire grew, conquered other countries, it found it difficult to sync all the different calendars. No fooling. So to fix this, in 46 BC, Julius Caesar borrowed from Egypt and instituted a single solar calendar based on the sun. It was called the Julian calendar, with 365 days, the amount of time it takes, apparently, for the Earth to rotate around the sun. But there was a problem. Each year was 6 hours short. So to keep it accurate, every 4 years, the Julian calendar added an extra day, a leap day. And, you know, that's what February the 29th is all about. The Julian calendar also officially recognized that the Romans moved the beginning of the year from March to January the 1st. January was named after Janus, the Roman god in charge of doors, from where we get the word janitor. March was named after Mars, the Roman god of war. Remnants of March, being the old first month, is still in our calendar with the names September, October, November, and December. Sept is Latin for seven, but now September is the ninth month. Are you confused yet? Stay with me. Oct is Latin for eight, as in octagon, an eight-sided figure, but now October is the 10th month. Nov is Latin for 9, but now it's the 11th month. And Dec is Latin for 10, as in decimal, divisible by 10, but it's now the 12th month. And Rome's old 5th month, Quintilis, was renamed after Julius Caesar and is called July. Since it only had 30 days, Julius Caesar took a day from the old end of the year, February, and added it to July, giving the month 31 days. Why are they doing this? Why can't we have 28 days and 13 months? The next emperor, Augustus Caesar, renamed the old 6-month Sextilis after himself, calling it August. He also took a day from the old end of the year, February, added it to August, giving that month 31 days, and leaving February with only 28 days. Is your head hurting? Mine is. Augustus Caesar also had his version of global surveillance to track everyone. It was called a census or a tax enrollment. Okay, Luke 21:1-3. In those days, there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all of the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And if everybody had to be taxed, everyone had to go into their own city to be taxed. Romans persecuted Christians for 3 centuries in 10 major persecutions until Emperor Constantine issued the Edict of Milan in 313 AD, legalizing Christianity. And just as Julius Caesar unified the Roman Empire with the Julian calendar, Constantine wanted to unify the Christian Roman Empire by having everyone use the same date to celebrate Christ's resurrection, the most important event in the Christian calendar. If anyone thought the birth of Jesus is all about Christianity, it is not. It is the supposed, I don't believe it happened, crucifixion and ascension into heaven that defines Christianity. Moving on. Just as Julius Caesar unified the Roman Empire with the Julian calendar, right? Constantine wanted to unify the Roman Empire by having everyone use the same date to celebrate Christ's resurrection, the most important event in the Christian calendar. Well, I just said that. Thank you. The Apostle Paul declared in 1 Corinthians 15:20, but now is Christ risen from the dead and become the first fruits of them that slept. Okay. At the Council of Nicaea, 325 AD, Constantine insisted that Easter be on a Sunday. They just can't come to an agreement, these blokes, can they? Anyway, this was the defining moment. It separated Jewish Christians, as Jesus and his disciples were Jewish, in case anybody forgot that, from the emerging Gentile church. Gentile meaning not Jewish. Prior to Constantine, Christians would ask Jewish rabbis when Passover would be celebrated each year, which was the 14th day of the Hebrew month of Nisan. Yes, like the car. The Latin word for 14ths is quattrodeciman. Stay with me. Since Constantine wanted Easter on Sunday and the Jewish day related to Passover could occur on any day of the week, it turned into the quarto decimanism controversy. Quarto decimanism controversy. Okay, that might come up later. Constantine ended the controversy by creating a non-Jewish formula to determine the date of Easter on a Sunday. It would be the first Sunday after the first paschal full moon falling on or after the spring equinox. All right, I'm just going to have to abbreviate this and move straight into the Middle Ages here somewhere. Let's see how far I can take this. Okay, let's go to the Celts. The Celtic date of Easter was very meaningful, as that was the day St. Patrick confronted the Druid chieftain King Logair, King Leary, as they called him, 433 AD, and that resulted in a large number of Irish converting to Christianity. A very important date. Nevertheless, at the Synod of Whitby Abbey in 664 AD, King Oswin of Northumbria agreed to have the Celtic Church come under the authority of the Roman Catholic Church and adopt its liturgical table of dates. People didn't really like that. However, it is what it is. Gradually, they started to bring in the BC and the AD, Anno Domini, after the Lord, BC, before Christ. In the late 19th century, secular academia popularized the use of BCE and CE, Common Era and Before Common Era. The birth of Christ, really, I mean, that's what it is. In their attempt to ignore Christ, they said, the secularists, in their attempt to ignore Christ by not mentioning Christ, they nonetheless acknowledge him with this, because the point where Common Era becomes, before Common Era becomes Common Era, is what is generally accepted as the birth of Christ. Then many more problems, many more discussions. We have the Council of Tours, made 12 days between Christmas, December 25th, and Epiphany. You know, they said, well, this is the 12 days of Christmas when the wise men visited, and they were called holy days, which then became holidays. And, you know, everyone's getting very confused. And then the Julian calendar, upon which the liturgical church tables are based, had a discrepancy, and that was off by 11 minutes and 14 seconds every year. And because of this, Easter's date incrementally moved 10 days ahead of the liturgical church tables, based on Constantine's formula. And oh my God, this is such a mess. And on and on and on and on. And by the time we get to the pilgrims landing in Massachusetts on November 11th, 1620, in the old style Julian calendar, people are getting very, very confused between, okay, what about the Gregorian calendar? Now, 1752, England and its colonies adopted a Gregorian calendar. But by that time, there was an 11-day discrepancy between the old style and the new style. Eventually, America finally adjusted its calendar the day after September the 2nd, 1752. Old style became September the 14th, 1752. We've lost some days there. People were confused. People were rioting. As you know, countries all over the world were getting, what day is it? What time is it? There are even reports of armies arriving late to battle because they had different calendars. Eventually, how it happened, God only knows, but we did decide on January the 1st to become recognized as New Year's Day. And as far as I'm concerned, we should have 13 months and 28 days each month. And darlings, my God, thank you for sitting through that. And that was just even half of it. I missed out the entire Middle Ages there. But I am going to have to say, folks, that's it for today. I have finished my drink, and that always means the end of the show. I hope you enjoyed listening in as much as I enjoyed recording, because I had a blast and it all went far too quickly. Today's real life cocktail was a classic champagne cocktail. And here's how you make it. Get a sugar cube, and you'll need 2 to 3 dashes of aromatic bitters. You need 1 ounce of really good brandy, 4 to 6 ounces of champagne to taste. I'll go with 6. An orange slice for garnish, and of course, a really good Luxardo cherry for garnish. Do not use the cheap stuff. Gather up your ingredients. Get a champagne flute. Place the sugar cube at the bottom of the champagne flute. Saturate the cube with bitters. Add the brandy, garnish with the orange and the slice, and then top it up with the champagne. Champagne goes in last on a champagne cocktail, and it goes in just before you're going to serve it. You can keep the bitters and you can keep the brandy in the glass, but you top it up with the champagne just before you're going to drink it, and it's bubbly and it's refreshing and it's just delicious. But it does have a kick, because there's brandy in it. So don't knock it back. Sip it elegantly, okay? Now, remember, folks, cocktails are great if they are an occasional treat. And I bet a great many of you overdid it last night and are rather groggy today. If you use top shelf ingredients and take the art of mixology seriously, darlings, I assure you, I know, one drink is all you need. I'm Ani, mad as the day is long, Avedisian. This was a Metaphysical Martini, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio, to whom we are so grateful. And a shout out to mysticalwares.com in Mount Vernon, Washington, for arranging the intergalactic distribution of this most excellent show. Until we meet again, Remember, we are entering the new golden age, and we should act accordingly. What does that mean? I don't know, darlings, but I'm sure we'll figure it out if we let the spirit inhabit the human.
You have been listening to The Metaphysical Martini with Ani Avedisian, the Mad Shaman, a production of CosmicReality.com.